Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. Right now, our guest is Dr. Peter Lilback, and we're going to focus on the subject of ministers and the founding of America. But specifically, we're going to look at two brothers who were Lutheran ministers, and they had very interesting thoughts about America and specifically about Christian pastors getting involved in politics. Should they or should they not? And I think this is fascinating. Dr. Lilback, thank you so much for joining us again.
Jerry, it's a great honor, and I appreciate those who listen and care about these things that we love to discuss.
All right, providenceforum.org for more information of Dr. Peter Lilback's ministry when it comes to all this stuff related to God and the founding of America. Now, let's go ahead and tell us about the Muhlenberg brothers.
Okay, well, to get started, people might say, what in the world did ministers of the gospel have to do with America? Let me name some quick names. We can't talk about all of them here, but we should talk about Roger Williams, William Penn, George Whitfield, John Witherspoon, and three Muhlenbergs, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, Frederick Muhlenberg, and Peter Muhlenberg. So we're going to talk about the Muhlenberg family here. And so put yourself back into the time of colonial America. This new world is starting to form. Immigrants are coming. Many of them are coming from Europe, and they are coming for religious freedom, opportunity to start again. And so Germans actually started moving in quite substantially into Philadelphia. William Penn had encouraged these settlers to come. And it's fascinating, if I remember correctly, Pennsylvania only fell two votes short of making German one of the official languages of Pennsylvania. We've often wondered how history might have changed if we had an official German-speaking state in America, how
yeah.
that might have impacted World War I, World War II, etc. But be that as it may, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg is sent over to plant the Lutheran Church. He is actually a missionary coming from Germany to begin the process. And now in modern Philadelphia, there's a place called Germantown, but it's just part of the city. But that was once a separate city, a day's journey at least away from old Philadelphia in the old days, and that's where obviously many Germans settled. So along comes the Lutheran Church. It begins to be developed, and he has two sons, the missionary, and he wants his two sons also to have theological training and to have Lutheran doctrine clearly in mind. And so they are sent back to Halle, Germany, to study in the pietistically oriented seminary there, where they would have a strong view on godliness and missions and Luther's theology, a high view of the Bible, and they're trained in classical languages, and they are sent back to America. Peter Muhlenberg will settle in Virginia, and Frederick Muhlenberg will settle in New York City. Peter in Virginia will actually come in contact with George Washington, and my understanding is they actually had opportunity to know each other and on occasion fox hunted together. In New York City, Frederick will become part of the fabric of that now small city, not nearly as big as the big city of Philadelphia. That seems counterintuitive today. That's the way it was then. And he will become part of an Episcopal church, or then an Anglican church. The Lutherans and Anglicans have often had close relationships through the years. And so they're both doing their ministry. And then on one particular Sunday, as all of the tensions are building in colonial America, Peter Muhlenberg gets up and he's in his reformational preaching robe, a nice Lutheran black preaching garment. And he turns to Ecclesiastes 3 and he says, there's a time for war and there's a time for peace. And he preaches a sermon at the end. He opens his robe and says, this is a time for war. And he asks some men in the back to get their drums ready, and they begin to beat it out, the cadence. And he says, I want every man here to march with me to defend the dearest liberties of conscience. And so guess what, ladies? You finally got your husband to church on a Sunday after all this time, and he marches off to war for 8 years.
Yeah.
What an amazing moment that had to be. And so there is now then the Muhlenberg Brigade from Virginia. When you come to Valley Forge, not far from Westminster Seminary here in Philadelphia, you can actually go to a place where the markers, this is where the Muhlenberg Brigade was. And so quite remarkably, a minister on a Sunday says, I'm going to become an officer. He has the uniform under his robe. He leads his men off, and off they go to war.
You know, let me just stop you. Let me just stop you real fast. Mel Gibson took that idea and incorporated it in his movie, The Patriot. But, you know, not mentioning that guy by name, but it was based on that story. Secondly, I just want to point out that in the U.S. Capitol, there's a statue of Peter John Muhlenberg in the process of disrobing, and you can see he's wearing the Continental uniform underneath. Yes, go on, proceed.
Is that in Statuary Hall?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's where to find it. Okay, so now the news gets to his brother, and his brother is up in New York, and from all reports, his brother was very upset with his brother. He was abandoning the ministry. He's getting involved in politics. And after all this investment and becoming a theologian, he's now becoming a military officer. And so the process of critique and criticism goes on until this Frederick Muhlenberg in New York has an epiphany. The British come to town and they burn his church down. Mm. You say, why did they do that? Well, it's because the churches were often viewed as a place of resistance and colonial opposition to the British imposition of their taxation and the king's will and punishment for the resistance to his plans. And so it could have been because of his brother's connection, even in knowing there's a Muhlenberg officer, a Muhlenberg preacher, let's attack. We don't know all the reasons. But at that moment, Frederick says, you know what, my brother is right. And so he has to leave. He has no church left. He has to kind of leave the area. And over time, he becomes settled in an area in Pennsylvania, as I understand it, and because he's such a highly educated man, and because of all the pressure, he will end up actually becoming a political leader in his community. Mm. As a result, he's elected to the first Congress under the Constitution. And because of his, I think because of his leadership and scholarship, he is actually elected as the Speaker of the House of the United States Representatives. So that when the Bill of Rights are now before the states and the Congress and they're ratified, he becomes one of the men who are privileged to sign the Bill of Rights along with Vice President John Adams. And now here we have John Peter Muhlenberg's brother, who once opposed the general, now is the congressman minister signing the right for every preacher of the gospel to know that the government will not persecute them. They're not going to come and burn our church down. They're not going to silence our pulpit. And so to me, it's a wonderful privilege of history to realize a minister of the gospel who heard the call to serve God's people and the kingdom of God by entering into public service actually preserves the freedom of gospel preaching for every minister in America.
Well, that's
the signer of the Bill of Rights.
That's fantastic. I'm sorry for interrupting at the end there. Just real fast, Dr. M. E. Bradford, the late Dr. Bradford, I once interviewed him. He was a professor at the University of Dallas, and he told me that there was a credible threat that if Great Britain won in squelching the rebellion in America, that's the way they viewed our war for independence, if they won, they would end up imposing the Anglican bishopric system throughout all the colonies. So all those things that the Puritans sacrificed for 150 years before, the Pilgrims and the Quakers and, you know, all these different people that came over for religious freedom, all of a sudden, all of that would be undone. Any comment on that?
Yes. There's several. If we look carefully at the Declaration of Independence, once it goes through its beginning with all of its lofty words, and it then calls the current king a tyrant, a despot, it lists all the grievances that demonstrate that that charge is not given lightly or without fact. And one of the things it mentions is the Quebec Act. Basically what happened is, you remember, Quebec was basically a British area, but it had a long history of Roman Catholic French people. And as a result of the Quebec Act, it not only recognized legitimacy of the Catholic religion in Quebec, but it pulled the border of all the way from Canada down to the Ohio River. And what that meant is it was saying, now there's Roman Catholic authority. surrounding you Protestant colonies, and we are going to make sure you're going to kowtow to our religious concerns. And so they saw the idea of a bishopric system actually in the Roman Catholic system being permitted, and it would have been a fearful thing. So that when you look at the words of the First Continental Congress, 1774 September, and you look at their minutes, they will talk about the ancient free Protestant colonies seeking to resist the danger of the Inquisition, because the Inquisition was still going on in Spain and France, in Europe. And now they were worried that Massachusetts, the Puritans, would in fact be under not just British control, but even possibly Roman Catholic influence that would be directly on their border, unable to be protected because the British were not looking out for their concerns. We also know that they, as you go through the grievances, it talks about how their courts were closed and different, the Constitution of Massachusetts, which was the center of the Puritan colony, the charter was entirely set aside. They were preparing to rebuild, if you will, what the new world would look like, and it would be under the strong hand of the British monarchy and its established church, and even giving greater rein to the Catholic religion, which at that time was a sworn enemy to the Protestant faith. So yes, I believe that Professor Bradford's interpretation comports with what we know just looking at the Declaration itself and putting it in its historical context.
It's interesting, too, going back to the Anglican as well, the Anglican tradition, they had a situation where King James, so now we're going back to the early 1600s, and he died in 1625, but he had a phrase, no bishops, no king. He was persecuting, of course, the pilgrims, but he also persecuted the Puritans, and part of that whole point was he felt that these rebellious Christian dissidents were not, respecting the bishops, but he would basically be able to control his subjects religious-wise through the bishops. So again, no bishops, no king. So this is a really important fact. I mean, talked about, the reason for the revolution had to do with no taxation without representation. Yeah, but there's a religious component that's often left out.
Yeah, that's correct. I think the way to get at it is this. When King James says no bishop, no king, he was saying if you establish a republican form of government in the church, which we would call a Presbyterian system, a representative government system, not a king in the church, not a bishop in the church, but a group of people ruling together by the election of the people, a presbytery, a group of elders, then the logic would be if the holy things of God can be governed by a republic, well, then clearly the republic is not an evil idea for the state. And kings were terrified at the notion of a republic because the word republic, res publica, when you translate it into English, literally it's a thing of the people. And that's why our Constitution begins with the three words, we the people. It's not I, the king, say to you. Remember, like King Louis XVI, I am the state, I'm the king. No, this is a republican government. And so King James could see if we let Presbyterianism happen in Scotland and not resist it, and if we let it have its leaven into England, there won't be long until we have a republican form of government in the state, and the king is going to be removed. So the church's bishops were a logical and practical defense of monarchy, which was absolutely close to the king's heart in his rule. So it's a fascinating argument that continues on, not just from when it was said there, but when it's brought to America, the desire to impose the Anglican Church as part of the rule of the king. It would have continued, and it was part of then. That is why it's interesting. I think Washington will say, the Presbyterians are my most loyal men. All of Washington's officers were essentially Presbyterian and Reformed men.
Wow.
They all stood together because they saw the need to protect themselves from the imposition of the republican form of government as well.
All right, Dr.
Bishopric system.
Exactly. Dr. Peter Loback, again, providenceforum.org for more information. Thank you, Dr. Loback. Always a pleasure.
Great to be with you, Jerry.